Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, breaking news from a few weeks ago. As is tradition on this podcast, we're getting to things right as they happen a few weeks after. But WikiLeaks released 9,000 pages of CIA files, calling it Vault 7. This hack was all over the news. It catalogs the agency's hacking techniques, including exploits of Android and iOS phones and Samsung smart TVs. Is your TV listening to you? That's what we're going to talk about today with two of my favorite people in tech policy, Heather West, Senior Policy Manager for the Americas at Mozilla. Heather, thanks for joining.
Of course, thank you.
And friend of the show, Mika Ouyang, Vice Hello. President for the National Security Program at Third Way, a centrist think tank here in D.C. Mika, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll give you guys a chance to just give me your gut reaction. When this hack happened, were you at all surprised that the CIA had let hacking tools get out into the public?
No, I think post-Snowden, the idea that there's going to be another major revelation of what the intelligence community is up to, we should just put it on a schedule.
About every 6 months, I think.
Yeah. No, but what's interesting is, like, how did it get to WikiLeaks? I think that it existed, that it got out, unfortunate, but... Yeah, at this point, knowing WikiLeaks' background, like, how did it get there? Who put it out? Who was the go-between? So many questions.
Yeah.
I think as Mika says, it's not surprising that the CIA has these tools. I think that that's a pretty well-accepted truth at this point. It is, you know, it does bring into question how they are protecting those tools and, you know, preventing leaks like this. Badly, apparently.
Yeah, and here's the key question, right? And this is the question that everyone in the intelligence community is asking, and you're asking, you know, and what we're talking about on the show today is, who has the more important interest here? So the government, when it hoards a vulnerability and doesn't tell a company, you could imagine that they think that by not telling the company, they can maybe do research on it, they can try to invite attacks from foreign governments and figure them out. They clearly think there's some value in not telling the company. The company is like, hey, we have a responsibility to our customers and our shareholders and the world to try to keep communication safe. We have a compelling interest. And this weighing of the two interests is something called the vulnerabilities equities process. For the rest of the show, we're going to call it VEP. So that is a nice DC acronym that people in tech policy are very familiar with, but not necessarily a household topic. But the VEP, this was started under the last president. And essentially, President Obama's administration said, we're basically just going to have a presumption towards disclosure, right? So that when we discover that there's a vulnerability in a company's software, we're going to tell them unless we have some other reason. Is that fair? I mean, is that how this has been going?
There are very legitimate interests for the government to have these tools as they go through their, you know, intelligence collection, law enforcement, and other you know, operational pieces. I think rather than asking whose interest is more important, the thing that the vulnerabilities equities process gets really right is that word equities, and they're balancing the equities. They're not trying to decide that one is more important than the other, but looking at the totality of the information about a particular tool, about who knows that vulnerability exists, how many users it has. Michael Daniel really laid out a pretty good set of considerations in a blog post post-Heartbleed talking about this VEP undertaking.
And Heartbleed was a 2014 attack that people estimate affected like two-thirds of the internet. So this was a big one.
It was huge. And there had been some speculation that the U.S. government had known about the vulnerability, maybe even operationalized it. In reaction, the White House did put out this blog post and say, wait, no, we didn't know about it, but here's how we treat these kinds of exploits, these vulnerabilities. And in many ways, I think, surprised some people that there was this bias towards disclosure. That does seem to be the right answer, because as we all know, you know, everyone uses all of these off-the-shelf software, whether you're in government, whether you're in the intelligence community, whether you're part of the defense, you know, department.
Maybe you're a journalist in Russia.
You're a journalist in Russia. Maybe you just like having encrypted messaging on your phone. You know, the idea that these exploits are only used against, you know, enemies of the state would be misguided. Because it's also unlikely, you know, Heartbleed is an excellent example. Multiple people discovered the vulnerability at the same time.
Yeah, and when we talk about how earlier this month WikiLeaks released 9,000 pages, that doesn't mean that that's when this actually happened, right? And is that one of the problems here where it's unclear the timeline between the hack happening, the vulnerability being disclosed, or sorry, the vulnerability being discovered by the government, and then when did WikiLeaks get its hands on this? I mean, is there a disconnect between when the public hears about these things in news reports and when they actually happen?
Oh, yeah. And I think there should be, right? Like the agency's job is to try and get access to, you know, foreign targets' communications, and that's how they use these vulnerabilities. I think there is some question about, right, when you see a big cache like this of all these vulnerabilities, what's the rate at which they're actually used, right? Are you one-offing a vulnerability here and there against a particular target, or like, you know, the Russians, are you trying to compromise, you know, hundreds of thousands of accounts all at the same time? I think the American government thinks of itself as, in most cases, a much more targeted actor. Doesn't have the manpower to process, take off of hundreds of thousands of accounts, especially if they're in foreign languages. So they're looking at, you know, small numbers of targets. And so, you know, when you see a disclosure like this and think, oh my God, 8,000 pages of documents and all these vulnerabilities across all these technology platforms, you know, the assumption is like that, you know, if you own any of those, that somebody's listening. And that's just not true. They don't have the bandwidth to actually be listening and processing this all at the same time. But you are going to find out later. Vulnerabilities get patched. Some of the vulnerabilities that were revealed had already been patched. You know, I think there is a time lag, but that's part of the process.
I think the intelligence community would like us to believe this is a big nothing burger, right? I mean, you've heard some arguments like, look, these are 2 years old, and in an internet time, that's forever. That you've already had a software update. I think iOS 10 wasn't even around. So anyone on iOS 10, like, probably can just kind of forget about it. But is that fair? I mean, or should we learn, what should we be learning from this? If not everyone freaking out that they've gotten hacked, what is the lesson to be learned from such a momentous event?
I think that there's, you know, the lesson to be learned here is that it is important to actually go back and fix these vulnerabilities. You know, not in the WikiLeaks trove, but for example, in the Shadow Brokers trove, there was active 0 days that were used against existing customers and existing technologies.
And when we say 0 day, we mean that is an exploit that the government knows about but does not disclose, right?
Exactly.
Anybody, not just the government.
Oh, okay.
The manufacturer doesn't know about.
Right.
Yes. The canonical, you have 0 days to fix it.
Ah, okay.
But they, you know, that put, and I believe that was believed to be NSA tools, that put existing technology users globally at risk, and they, you know, did see attacks. I think that, you know, iPhones, you know, hopefully were able to patch quickly, but not everyone is on the latest software, regardless of whether you're on iPhone, whether you're on Android. You know, I heard that the Samsung TVs were patched. I think there's this mishmash of best practices around these security vulnerabilities. And, you know, if we can go back and make sure that they get fixed and, you know, have a robust disclosure process, I think that protects a lot more people.
So what does the current vet process look like when the government figures out that there's a vulnerability in a piece of software or hardware or whatever? How do they decide whether to tell the company or whether to hold on to that to potentially use for whatever?
So according to Michael Daniels' blog post, which is really the most authoritative public document we have from the government on this, an agency, for example, the NSA, may choose to nominate a vulnerability to this process to have the equities balanced and kind of determine whether they should disclose it or whether they should hold on to it and potentially operationalize it. They have not published the list of considerations that are undertaken when they make that determination. And the processes and procedures around VEP are very opaque, mostly classified, and folks just don't talk about them a lot. When we're thinking about VEP and what we would want to fix, that's one of the major things. It would be fantastic if we had a better understanding of how these processes work, and it would inspire some trust in the process, even though there wouldn't be transparency into individual decisions.
And you work for Mozilla. Mozilla Firefox browser, enormously popular, one of the most widely used browsers in the world. I mean, what is the trust situation between companies and the government right now on stuff like this? And do companies not have every incentive to just try to outpace the government rather than cooperate with them? If you want to show your customers that you're the best and the most secure, you can do a big public display like the Apple FBI case and say, no, we're not going to help you because it's not worth it to have that vulnerability out there. is trust at a bad level right now, would you say, between companies and the government in terms of VEP?
I think it's actually, it really varies by company business model. There are companies that both serve private sector customers and serve the government. There are companies that are more concerned about their enterprise customers, so they get more concerned about what the government thinks and less concerned about what you and I as individual users might think. There are companies who sell security as a benefit at the front end, like Apple. There are companies that provide security, but they're actually also mining your data as they let you use free services like Google and Facebook. It really depends on sort of how the company, how user-faced the company is and how concerned they are about their revenue streams walking away as to how confrontational they want to be with the government. But a lot of these disclosures from Snowden on have really soured relationships between companies and the government, and in particular for companies who might otherwise want to cooperate with the government because they want to help them catch terrorists or Russian spies or whatever. They feel like, well, maybe I can't do that because I have some downside risk for public disclosure. The government can't guarantee that my assistance to them for something that I actually think is good, that they actually think is good, will be kept secret. And that's a real problem for government cooperation when you are trying to figure out how to target some of these people who are intent on doing harm to America.
And there are a lot of people that we work with in tech policy who were very sympathetic to the government case in Apple FBI. And it might be worth reexamining how that all went down. You know, Apple did not want to build an exploit for this phone of the dead terrorist in the San Bernardino attack. Big public debate. America split. They end up outsourcing it, the FBI, to an Israeli cybersecurity firm. They get hacked. The vulnerability is now out there. And you could argue different ways about that. You know, if you're sympathetic to Apple and the privacy community, you could say, look, the fact that the CIA has been hacked, this Israeli firm have been hacked, it proves our point that merely the existence of the vulnerability itself is a problem because these tools cannot be safeguarded. Now, a more pro-government person would say, look, actually, maybe we should be decentralizing this. Maybe companies themselves should cooperate because a company like Apple has better data security than the cybersecurity firm in Israel. And if the companies actually cooperated and held on to these vulnerabilities themselves, they wouldn't need to be hoarded by the CIA. Just to point out that basically everything that happens in this debate could be spun either to say that the privacy community is winning or that the government has a good point. I mean, how do you guys judge all this stuff?
It's incredibly complicated. And again, this is a balancing of equities. From our perspective, the government asking Apple to circumvent their own security protections would be a massive overreach. Asking people to break their own products is not the right answer. I think that there are situations where law enforcement needs new tools, but they need to be thinking creatively, not just asking for the sledgehammer, which was essentially what they asked Apple for.
As encryption becomes more prolific and more people adopt it, there is a legitimate concern from the law enforcement community that they will not be able to do their jobs. And while, you know, maybe people in the libertarian sphere say, screw you, you're just trying to fight the drug war, I don't care if you get into the meth dealer's phone or not, there are some more interesting cases like child pornography and terrorism, right? Things that most people would say are legitimate government functions. So how do you circumvent encryption? How do you help the government get what it needs without destroying the product? I mean, how do you improve the VEP to make the right outcome here?
So I think one of the challenges is you don't want companies engineering security flaws in, because that makes the products weaker. That leaves them vulnerable to exploit by not just our government, but by hostile governments around the world, criminals, all kinds of things. So you don't want to do that. But, you know, all this concern about end-to-end encryption and going dark, what that means is that the government can't just sit behind a desk and a computer somewhere in the United States and, like, tap a few keys and figure out what people are up to. They may actually have to expend some shoe leather, which is dangerous to the people that actually do this, and go out into the field and recruit sources and figure out other ways of doing this.
Human intelligence, old
human
school.
Old school human intelligence. But not only that, like, there are other places in this chain, in this multi-layered communications chain, where you can get the information. It doesn't have to be at end-to-end encryption. What we saw in this, you know, Vault 7 release is that you could figure out how to compromise the end device for the user. There are other places where you can compromise as well. So there are so many options for collection that it's not like the government's going dark. As we turn over more and more of our lives to people, and like Alexa's always listening, like there are places where they can get access to things where they never thought they could have access to things before. It's not really going dark, but yeah, you might actually have to, you know, talk to some people and go out into the field and like compromise some folks.
Yeah. I mean, or do some targeted work. And if you know who you're targeting, it's probably easier to compromise that individual phone than blanket surveillance. I want to get to potential legislative fixes and Congress's role, but something interesting in Mozilla's statement after the CIA hack that I kind of want to hone in on, because you could probably see people in the privacy community welcoming the CIA hack, not because they want people to get hacked, but because it kind of proves their point, right? That because the CIA got hacked, they were able to all say, aha, I told you that you shouldn't be doing that, right? But at the same time, Mozilla's statement was very critical of WikiLeaks. And why? I'm curious because, you know, many privacy people, they probably have complicated views, right? There's this connection to Trump, not a hugely liked figure in the privacy community necessarily. But then they also do stuff like the Chelsea Manning hacks, which brought to light many improper things the U.S. government was doing. And then you can have complicated views about Snowden too. But why so critical of WikiLeaks?
So they're within the technical community, there's a fairly well understood set of practices around disclosing vulnerabilities. And that's because the best way to protect users is to make sure that companies know about these vulnerabilities before they're publicly released. At no point in these, you know, well understood processes for vulnerability disclosure is there a step that says surprise the company. The fact that WikiLeaks went out with this, and they tried, they did some redactions, but from what I am told from some of the folks I talked to on the technical side, the redactions were not comprehensive enough to really protect these products. They should have gone either, and I'm equally critical of the CIA and WikiLeaks here.
Right. That was what was interesting, is that you said both of these actors had kind of failed here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either of them could have, done that disclosure. Either the CIA, after they realized they had lost control of this particular trove of exploits, or WikiLeaks when they got it and prior to sensationalizing it. Either of those steps would have been a much more responsible way to do this, and would have prevented potential compromises of end users, And really, at that point, then, you know, there is a step in the disclosure process where you do talk about this publicly and you say either I fixed it or we talked to these guys and they didn't fix it. And really, I think WikiLeaks, misstepped there. And I think the CIA could have done a better job as well.
Is that just politics? I mean, they're trying to shock people. They're trying to make news.
Yeah, seems I think likely. They're trying to change the story. I mean, I think the disclosure came at a period of time where we were talking a lot about Trump's connections to Russia. The National Security Advisor had resigned over failure to do that. We found out that the Attorney General had not disclosed all their contacts with the Russian ambassador. They should have in front of the Senate. It was a bad series of stories. WikiLeaks, which has become unabashedly partisan over the course of the campaign, is no longer just an information should be free organization, but one that like was selling anti-Bill Clinton t-shirts for no good reason during the campaign. Like they were, you know, put something out there that was going to change the subject. Now, I think that you really have to question their motives. It's not the kind of transparency organization that they claimed to be when they started. And that makes some of what they're doing really suspect. On the other hand, I think that the agency has to really think carefully about their vulnerabilities and think about how long they're out there, because they're not the only ones looking for them. Other governments are looking for them. Criminals are looking for them. And it's almost like you got to put a stopwatch on these things from the moment the version is released and realize every day that it's out there longer, someone else is likely to find it and use it. And you are leaving vulnerabilities the longer it is. Like there should be a sense of ephemeralness to the use of these vulnerabilities. And the longer you hold them, the more likely they could be disclosed or someone else could use them. And you are compromising your own people by leaving it unpatched. And yeah. I think that's when you don't talk about the considerations that are part of the VEP, you don't get the sense that the government is actually taking that time constraint into consideration.
Yeah, and I think that cues up pretty nicely. There were a couple of studies out recently, one from RAND and one from a couple of academics at Harvard, talking about, you know, trying to go into some data sets and figure out how often and how long it takes for people to rediscover a vulnerability. And that is, if I know about this vulnerability, how likely is it that someone else does too? And I think, you know, we don't have any good conclusions on that other than it's very contextual and complicated. But it's important that they take that into consideration and they really say, hey, what is this risk? What does that look like? And it's got to be one of the primary drivers of their equities.
And earlier I asked you to kind of describe what VEP looks like today. And your answer was very much, that's the part of the problem is that we don't know. And that basically the CIA, NSA, other agencies are doing this all internally. And they're making these determinations and we don't really know what the criteria are. That probably makes it difficult to legislate a solution to a problem you don't fully understand. Nonetheless, Mozilla is forging ahead. And what is Congress's role here? And are we going to see legislation from Congress that changes the way that VEP is done?
VEP is an incredibly wonky process. And that has meant that a lot of people have been kind of poking around and thinking about it for a little while. I do think that there are some really concrete things that Congress could do to codify VEP and make sure that it continues, as well as create some kind of transparency around processes, some accountability and reporting to help us understand what's actually going on here. I think that that is a win-win. I think putting some sunlight into the process, helping companies understand, helping users understand what those considerations look like would be incredibly helpful. Earlier today, Senator Brian Schatz actually mentioned that he's working on legislation with Senator Ron Johnson.
That's a Republican and a Democrat.
Indeed. It's the best combo. And I think that also shows that this is, you know, not necessarily a partisan consideration. This is something that you can step back and say, let's codify this process. Let's make sure that the agencies use it, and let's create some reporting to help people understand what's going on here. So there's, even though we don't know necessarily a lot about what's going on right now, about what the process looks like. And to be fair, what the administration's opinion about that process is. I think that there's plenty of places that we could look to legislation to help bring some clarity and make sure that people understand what to expect from the process.
And Mika, would you have any specific recommendations for either for Congress or for the agencies themselves to maybe do some good things proactively so that they can help rebuild the trust, because legislation could take forever?
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges with legislation, it's important. Right now, VEP is an executive branch only thing. It could just disappear with the wave of a wand.
It's discretionary. And that's what Heather was getting with codify, right? Like actually make them do it, because right now it's kind of up to them.
So, but the challenge on codification, right? Like I served as a staffer in Congress, like Congress can actually codify things and then the executive branch can still make it ineffective. And we've seen that happen with, say, the Federal Elections Commission or the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, the PCLOB, that does surveillance oversight, right? Like if they don't actually put funding towards it, tell people to do it, it can also still be technically on the books, but not really happening. So what Congress really needs to do, if they're committed to it, is not just pass legislation, but insist on oversight reports from the VEP, right? Annual, like how did it go? IG investigations, funding reports, things like that to make sure that it is for real. That takes sustained attention from members of Congress and from members of Congress who are going to be on the right committees to actually be able to do that. I'm not sure that you have the kind of buy-in across the chambers, both of them, to see that actually happens. You need more than two, because these two are not on the right committees, and you need people who are on the committees and seeing the budgets and doing the oversight who are really also committed to the process.
Now, practically, what this means for the end user, a lot of times when there's these big stories about hacks, people don't really conceptualize what it means for them unless they maybe got an email from a company they use saying, hey, you might have been part of a breach. But people like Edward Snowden, organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation have been going around telling people to adopt end-to-end encrypted messaging apps like Signal, like whatever, and that should give some people certain comfort that their messages are secure. Does the CIA hack, does Vault 7 really kind of illustrate that that's not enough, that just having end-to-end encrypted messaging apps might not be enough? And should people be more concerned? Should the average consumer be doing something in response to this conversation? Or is this all just inside baseball?
I think, when we step back and we look at what these tools really look like, one of the interesting things about them is that they're, most of them, from what we can tell, are fairly targeted. And that means, for example, to get access to root your iPhone, they needed access to your iPhone, which means that they probably just didn't wantonly do this to millions of people. So chances are good that, you know, you're going to get your identity stolen before the government's spying on you. That said, if someone pwns your phone, it doesn't matter what awesome apps you have installed because they're going to get it before it gets encrypted.
Yeah, they could like see you typing the message into the encrypted app, right? It's basically they have total control.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, no, I think that, look, people should use more security, not less. They should have two-factor authentication. They should update regularly. That's one of the things from the Vault 7 hack is some of these things had been patched by the time it was released. So everybody update. I know that the Adobe update announcements are like super annoying, but yes, you should just update.
Adobe seems to be like the go-to for like, you guys have too many updates.
It's like a bajillion clicks to get the thing to update. Like, I just want to be able to say yes and then have it run, but whatever. But like update regularly, two-factor authentication, biometric identifiers if you want. Like, yes, do all of those things. But at the same time, there is no such thing as perfect security. Like you can write a piece of something down on a piece of paper, show it to the other person, light it on fire. The other person could still talk, right? Like you just, there's no such thing as like perfect. It never gets out.
It's comforting. I like that. Is there anything you guys would like to plug? I mentioned, I'll put in the show notes, Mozilla had a statement in response to the hack and has kind of a primer on VEP, which is a very good first look at the process and what it's all about. I'll link to those things. Anything else you guys would like to plug?
I think that we're going to be coming out with a little bit more material on this, hopefully over the next few weeks. I will plug the Belfer Center's report, which is a fairly comprehensive collection of what's publicly known about VEP. I think it's very well put together. It's Ari Schwartz and Rob Kanacki, both of whom helped set this up within the National Security Council, and so they're quite knowledgeable. But it is of course only the public information.
Right. Mika?
No particular thing to plug. I would just encourage people to be a little bit more paranoid. For example...
More comforting. I like it.
For example, for all those people who are clicking on the WikiLeaks Vault 7 links, for all you know, that's a watering hole attack.
That's amazing.
Enjoy.
All right. After you do that, follow Tech Freedom on Facebook and Twitter. I assure you, we have not turned our social media into watering holes. Not because we don't want to, because we don't know how. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review. It will help others find the show. I'd like to thank my guests, Mika and Heather. You guys were wonderful, as always.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for having us.
Come back anytime. See you next time.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.